It is Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellum. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle.
Ahead on Ozarks, this region is a hotbed for a rare weather pattern called derechos. We talked to an expert forecaster about this interesting weather phenomenon.
Last week, the Fayetteville Public Library's Board of Directors voted to offer Washington Regional Medical Center $2 million for the city hospital property located directly south of the library campus. I'll talk with Library Director David Johnson about the library's expansion proposal.
But first, officials with the Arkansas Workers' Compensation Commission have confirmed that the commission's Fort Smith office will close. Though no date has been set, the office will reportedly be closed by this time next year. The closure is meant to help counteract a $135 million unfunded liability in its death and permanent disability trust fund. The fund services benefits to families of workers killed or permanently injured on the job after a certain deductible is met by workers' compensation insurance providers. AWCC Chairman Watson Bell said earlier this month that turbulent economic times have contributed to the trust fund shortfall.
We don't get any general revenue. We are what's called a special revenue agency. All we get is what we bring in. And what our revenue is a premium tax that comes from the people who pay workers' comp. And when that tax goes down, our revenue stream goes down. Our gross income is basically the same as it was 13 years ago. So you can see we've got a financial situation that we're having to deal with, and we're having to make some tough decisions.
According to the City Wire, the decision to close the Fort Smith office was made after considering input from staff at the Fort Smith and Springdale offices, communications received by the commission and the governor's office, and an analysis of cost information related to the issue. Of nearly 6,700 claims filed with the Workers' Compensation Commission during the fiscal year just completed, 322 claims were filed in Sebastian County, while 419 claims were filed in Washington County.
Entergy says a reorganization plan has led to the layoffs of 800 workers in several states, including 165 Arkansas workers. Arkansas Nuclear One in Russellville will be the site of some of those layoffs, according to Sally Graham, Entergy Arkansas spokeswoman. She says plans for the layoffs resulted from a money-saving effort by the multi-state utility.
Well, it is a changing business world, and, you know, in an effort to meet those challenges and opportunities, we did have a team of employees who devoted thousands of hours of analyzing how to make our business better. And the goal is to create a world-class organization focused on customer service, operational excellence, and sustainable value for our customers.
Entergy will also reportedly close a call center in the state as well.
A meeting is being held today between Arkansas officials and representatives of the Quapaw tribe to discuss artifacts from a Native American village that once sat near where a steel mill is to be built. The meeting in Osceola will include Arkansas Economic Development Director Grant Tenniel, the state archaeologists, and local officials. Tenniel says he doesn't believe the artifacts will impact the proposed Big River Steel Project.
We knew about them before it was ever announced, and we have hired some of the best experts in this region to work with us. They have been on site for months. We have a plan, and it both respects the artifacts and the culture and complies with state and federal law.
Today's meeting is not open to the public or press because officials say they don't want the location of the artifacts to be released for fear they would be plundered. The $1 billion project will employ 2,000 people during its construction and then have more than 500 workers.
North Little Rock will be home to a new entrepreneurial hub, which will house three interconnected ventures to provide education, training, and to help launch businesses. $2.5 million has been raised from private sources to create the Argenta Innovation Center. Barry Hyde, the committee chair, says it's an ambitious venture.
The Argenta Innovation Center will create a culture of innovation and job creation, retain and attract smart, talented people for Central Arkansas, generate new businesses, and contribute talent to existing ones.
The center will include educational opportunities and advanced technologies that can be used to turn ideas into tangible and marketable products.
Earlier this week, Bill Halter dropped out of the 2014 Arkansas governor's race, removing a primary challenge on the Democratic side of that ticket. And yesterday, word broke that another statewide race has similarly narrowed, According to Talk Business Arkansas, Little Rock School Board President Diane Curry has dropped out of the lieutenant governor's race. Curry is reportedly considering a run for Congress in the 2nd District against the incumbent Republican Congressman Tim Griffin. Curry's exit from the race for lieutenant governor leaves John Burkhalter as not only the lone Democrat in the race, but the only confirmed candidate in the race. Current Lieutenant Governor Mark Darr, a Republican, has not announced if he will seek re-election in 2014, though he is rumored to be eyeing a run for the 4th District seat in Congress if Congressman Tom Cotton decides to run against Senator Mark Pryor.
The Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics has released unemployment numbers for the month of June. The unemployment rate in Northwest Arkansas for the month was 5.7%. That's a drop of 0.2% compared to June 2012, but a bump up of 0.1% from May of this year. The number of unemployed in June 2013 was actually about 300 people higher than a year ago, but the overall labor force grew by about 3,300 people during the same time period.
In the Fort Smith metro area, the June jobless rate was 7.7%, an increase of 0.1% compared to June 2012, and dead even with the unemployment rate for May of this year. The overall labor force grew by about 1,800 people year over year.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals have dropped three in a row now. Last night, the Nats lost to the Travelers in North Little Rock 8-3. That three-game series will conclude tonight in North Little Rock.
Forecast calls for partly cloudy skies this evening. Overnight lows from 65 in northwest Arkansas to 73 in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow, your Thursday, with highs from 91 to 95 and a heat index value of 103 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with overnight lows from 72 to 75.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Four Corners region of Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Arkansas is at the epicenter of an unusual weather phenomenon known as derechos. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich talked with the nation's top derecho expert, and she has this story.
Well, derecho is actually a Spanish term. It's a derivative of a Spanish term that means direct or straight ahead.
Derecho expert Stephen Corfitti is lead forecaster with the Storm Prediction Center based in Norman, Oklahoma, a division of the National Weather Service. He and his colleagues work round-the-clock shifts to provide severe weather warnings and watches to meteorologists and the public. The center's website, spc.noaa.gov, is a trove of information and contains an entire section dedicated to derechos. Stephen Corfitti says the word derecho was coined back in the 1880s.
By a physics professor at the University of Iowa, Dr. Gustavus Heinrichs. And he recognized at a relatively early date that there was a distinction between the cyclones or tornadoes that were playing havoc on the settlers and early farmers that were settling, moving westward from the eastern United States into the mid-Mississippi Valley, upper Mississippi Valley. And he recognized that there was a class of storms that were distinct from the tornadic storm that were also significant and produced widespread damaging winds, particularly those that would flatten crops and knock buildings down, but they weren't rotary-type storms or turning-type storms like a typical tornado.
Derechos are rare events. Only a few occur each year, and you never hear them forecast because derechos are documented as such only after they occur, and they most commonly occur from May through Labor Day.
The conditions that are most favorable for derecho development include a large mass of very warm and humid air that is experiencing a certain amount of lift. And by lift, I mean meteorological lift. And that lift can come from a what you would call a cold front or a warm front or a low pressure system. And that lift preferentially has to be moving. So if the weather disturbance is moving and encountering a large swath of very warm and humid air, particularly if that air that is warm and humid at the surface is overlaying or has cooler air at the mid and upper levels of the atmosphere. In a derecho environment, the most likely setup wind-wise is to have the wind speed increasing with height and blowing from the same direction with height. So essentially what happens is you have a snowplow effect, that you get a mass of air starting to move in one direction and acting as a snowplow and lifting or overturning along the cold front or low pressure system a whole swath of that very warm and humid air. And when that overturning occurs, basically we're talking about thunderstorms, that thunderstorm is able to redevelop or replicate itself in that downstream direction.
Such severe and damaging wind events often appear on radar as bow echoes. Imagine a massive green archer's bow with a bursting red center.
Kind of in a backward C-shaped or a boomerang shape, that bowing shape to the line of strong echoes is an indication, more often than not, that very strong winds are reaching the surface behind the apex of the bow. In other words, the bow is bulged outward in the downstream direction, most forward. And those strong winds are basically what are acting as that snowplow to lift up the air violently, that warm and humid air near the surface. So once you start to see that bowing structure, basically you're essentially halfway toward having a derecho in progress.
You may also potentially spot a derecho in progress by looking up at the sky for unusual cloud formations along the horizon.
Derechos can, but not always, be accompanied by a very well-marked shelf or arcus cloud. And basically that it's a band of low, dark, angry-looking clouds, often showing some rotary or chaotic motions. And they represent the lowest part of the ascent that's going on the leading edge of the thunderstorm profile. So if you see a long arc of very dark, angry-looking clouds, surmounted by dark but not quite as dark clouds above, and usually the sky has already taken on a very a dusky hue and maybe sometimes greenish or bluish, that dark low roll of cloud, the shelf cloud or arcus cloud, is certainly one of the characteristics of some derechos, but unfortunately not all of them have that, and it all depends on the exact ingredients that are coming into place.
A few derechos have been documented in winter. Plus, they are not localized events, but generally involve at least several states.
But a true derecho typically extends in a more widespread fashion, maybe up to 150 or in some cases 200 miles, in a much larger scale bow structure. And then within that larger scale bow, you may have smaller winds embedded within it that are surging. They represent winds that are surging forward even more rapidly than those associated with that larger scale bow. And that's where the most intense damage can occur.
Derecho damage appears differently than tornado damage.
Derecho damage, of course, typically covers a much, much broader area. And the winds, like because they are coming out of the clouds in a more or less unidirectional or in the same direction, they tend to blow things down in a straight line path. So everything is just mowed down essentially, or snow plowed down. So the trees and other debris tend to all lie in the direction from which the winds are coming.
Stephen Corfitti and his colleagues have created a derecho climatology map, concentric region of frequency. And the quad state region of Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, and northwest Arkansas lie at the epicenter, with four derechos occurring every 3 years. That's because, Corfitti says, our atmosphere is fed both by the Gulf of Mexico and the southwestern Colorado Plateau.
Well, in this environment over the southern United States, and actually over a large part of the world, when severe thunderstorms are likely, you tend to have southerly winds near the ground, and then westerly winds at the mid-altitude, say 1 or 2 or 3 miles above you. And that's certainly the case over Arkansas when you're getting tornado or severe weather outbreaks.
The Storm Prediction Center publishes a detailed chronology of significant derechos. Two of note, the cross-country derecho, which occurred 2 years ago, traveled 1,300 miles over a 24-hour period from central high plains across the Great Lakes region into the mid-Atlantic states, clocking 100 miles per hour. The storm actually plowed up a seiche, a sudden swell on Lake Michigan. It was also the first time, SPC says, the word derecho was picked up and widely broadcast by media. Then there's the super derecho of 2009, cited as one of the most intense and unusual ever observed, traveling 1,000 miles from western Kansas to eastern Kentucky. It's documented as causing unprecedented continuous damage. Most recently, on July 23rd, A derecho packing 80-mile-per-hour winds was reported to have gusted over Tulsa. Here's some audio of that storm posted on YouTube. The derecho, which originated in southern Kansas, recorded the highest winds ever at Tulsa International Airport, dumped 5 inches of rain in some places, and produced baseball-sized hail. So given that our climate is warming, can we expect more frequent and intense derechos?
If indeed you warm the atmosphere, you're not just warming the surface, which of course would be a tendency, would be likely to produce more thunderstorms and possibly more derechos, but you're also warming the upper levels of the atmosphere. So if you warm the upper levels, say, more than you're warming the lower levels of the atmosphere will actually become more stable. And so it may get more humid and uncomfortable down near the ground, but it won't necessarily result in more storms. So it's a complex, you can't give an easy answer to that. And in addition, these changes in the thermodynamics affect the wind. So if you're warming the upper levels of the atmosphere also, you're also shifting the belt of stronger westerly winds aloft farther north. And again, that may either shift the corridor most likely to see derechos, or it may actually change it in such a way that they become less likely.
You can see for yourself how our weather is trending by bookmarking the National Weather Service Storm Prediction Center on your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. And many thanks to Stephen Corfitti, lead forecaster, for taking time on a Sunday afternoon to discuss the mysterious and destructive phenomenon known as derechos. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more about derechos, search for them on the Storm Prediction Center website at spec.noaa.gov.
It has been a political season full of controversies, and the one in Washington over the farm bill could be among those with the longest-lasting implications. That bill sets agriculture policy and deals with the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, also called SNAP. Arkansas Congressman Rick Crawford, who represents the state's 1st District, sits on the House Agriculture Committee. He was in favor of keeping those two parts of the bill combined, but he told Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas that he's concerned now that the two parts have been split, it could be difficult to find funding consensus for SNAP. Late last week, the congressman talked to Roby about the farm bill and the future of SNAP.
You still have the whole SNAP program funding there. I've got a quote that you put out in one of your press releases after the second vote that did actually pass. This is not a perfect bill, nor is this approach my first choice, was what your stated position was there. In the first combined farm bill, there would have been SNAP funding that would have been cut about $20 billion over a 10-year period. Do you think you can get a better deal than that?
I honestly don't think we can. I think that we have to be careful that that we don't overreach, and I think that's what we did in that first round, and we lost a lot of Democrat support. In fact, we had probably 40 to 50 commitments from Democrats that they defected because of a particular amendment that they just couldn't tolerate. So $20.5 billion in cuts, it's not even the number that I think we should focus on. It's the reforms in the program that I think are the most relevant in the approach that the House Ag Committee took. And I would also say that the House Ag Committee passed that bill on a 36-10 vote. That's a very bipartisan demonstration on the part of the House Ag Committee. So I would have been very, very comfortable to have passed that bill as it was. Now, obviously, you know, we're going to let the House work its will. And in this case, I think it was a little too much, and we lost the support we needed and had to come back with a different approach. So I preferred the first approach, and unfortunately, we fell short.
Does anything get done? Because it's obviously the second approach, the sense is that's not going anywhere, at least in the Senate.
Well, I'm afraid that what could happen, I don't know that this will happen, and I haven't been told this for sure, that we've taken the approach to decouple, which I didn't favor that approach. But the farm bill, or the commodity title of the farm bill, passed as it would have passed had we passed it. So not a whole lot of changes, with one exception, that was to repeal and replace the permanent law, the 1949 underlying default law. Beyond that, it's the same bill, other than there's no commodity title. So the idea is that, well, we'll pass a separate commodity title. Well, again, I don't know that we can pass a nutrition title. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we can pass a nutrition title in the time that we have, and if we don't, then we don't get any of the reforms that we set out in the original
because
House bill.
Because it's an entitlement program. It
right.
stays at the funding level where it's at.
Exactly.
Or actually
so
potentially
the
increases.
Reforms that we were looking at we really may have lost those in kind of an overzealous overreach to do more. I thought we struck a very good balance in being fiscally responsible, but not losing all the support we needed to advance the bill. And look, everybody's got to vote their conscience, and they got to vote their district. I have a large number of SNAP beneficiaries in my district, but I also know that we can do a better job with it. And that's where I think the reforms came in. And I'd also say that Arkansas is not one of those states that has been prone to abuse these programs. These reforms were dealing with categorical eligibility and the LIHEAP, or what we call the Heat and Eat program. And Arkansas has really done a stellar job in comparison to these other states. And so Arkansas would probably have not seen little, if any, change at all to their program.
Something doesn't get done on SNAP reform or this entitlement reform. Does Congressman Cotton and that section of the caucus, of the Republican caucus, should they be blamed for not getting done?
No, I think that at the end of the day, everybody has to vote the way they think they should vote, and everybody's going to have to live with that. But I'm certainly not going to cast blame or cast aspersions on anybody or question their motives. I do think, though, that what we do need to do is to take another approach and get a different perspective on this. One of the things that's been a challenge to me is, when I first got there, recognized immediately that the divide that exists in Washington, yes, there is partisanship, but there's as much of a geographic divide. And I'm going to tell you, here we are in Little Rock, and Little Rock is a big city, and the best city to live in for small, mid-sized cities. It's great. But we are a small town, and this is a small state. It's a rural state. And we are outnumbered. There's only four of us in the House of Representatives. And you compare that, heck, Houston is way bigger. Why does Houston care anything about what a rural state like Arkansas needs or wants? And the point I'm trying to make is that we need to bridge these gaps between urban demographics and rural demographics and try to come to some consensus that reflects the overall needs of the country.
Arkansas Congressman Tim Griffin is on the House Agriculture Committee and talked to Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, last week. You can see and hear more from the conversation at talkbusiness.net.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, as Congress debates immigration reform, the mayor of Nogales, Arizona, offers his thoughts on the border fence that runs through town.
For the economy, more harm, and I really don't think it stops anything. It just makes people feel good up in Washington.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, beginning this afternoon at 1 on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
A few things of note. World-renowned author James Patterson has established the James Patterson Teacher Education Scholarship Fund at the University of Arkansas. Patterson's gift of $48,000 will provide 8 scholarships in the amount of $6,000 each to students majoring in elementary or secondary education in the College of Education and Health Professions. In the past 3 years, Patterson has sold more books than any other author, according to Nielsen BookScan, a data provider for the book publishing industry. In total, his books have sold an estimated 207 million copies worldwide. Patterson has had 19 consecutive number one selling New York Times bestselling novels and holds the New York Times record for the most hardcover fiction bestselling titles by a single author, with 89, which is also a Guinness World Record. He is largely known for his novels about fictional psychologist Alex Cross. Patterson's gift to the University of Arkansas is similar to scholarships he has funded at Vanderbilt, Michigan State University, the University of Wisconsin, Howard University, and Appalachian State University.
He was actually a guest on Ozarks at Large a few years ago. He came to Rogers to talk as part of a fundraiser for Friends of the Rogers Library, and got to talk to him. A pretty nice guy.
Yeah, my mom likes to read his books.
He's written 900,000 books. I have yet to read one, but he was a very nice guy during the interview. Harvest Time Church in Fort Smith will be giving away backpacks stuffed with school supplies to those in need. The group plans to pass out 3,000 packs during this year's backpack giveaway, which has grown from 450 packs when the event began 4 years ago. Or just 3 years ago, I should say. To get a backpack, bring your child to either the Zero Street or Kelly Highway Walmart Saturday between the hours of 10 and noon. The event will coincide with Arkansas's tax-free weekend.
Which I actually just saw that area Sam's Clubs are opening up this weekend to non-members. So non-members can take advantage of Arkansas's tax-free weekend at Sam's Club.
It's like Christmas in August.
It is.
Yeah. Or Black Friday in August, I guess. Yeah.
The city of Springdale is considering the addition of 2 roundabouts to its current street improvement projects to make the total number of roundabouts in that city 5. Springdale follows other cities in the region that have added roundabouts in recent years, including Fayetteville, Bentonville, and Rogers. A public hearing on adding roundabouts to Springdale's 56th Street Improvement Project is scheduled from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. to 6:30, August 8th, in Council Chambers at the City's Administration Building, which is located at 201 Spring Street.
Perhaps the best view of South Fayetteville is here, on top of the Blair Library in downtown Fayetteville. You can see the Boston Mountains spreading out in front of you, peppered with the outlines of new apartment complexes. Directly below the lip of the library's roof is the now empty City Hospital. When David Johnson, the executive director of the Fayetteville Public Library, looks out here, he sees more than just a breathtaking view.
I see an opportunity for Fayetteville to actually develop a piece of unused property that will give back to the community. I kind of like to talk about Jeff Shearer, the architect, needing a big canvas to paint this beautiful expansion. And so I see, you know, a big piece of canvas that we're going to be able to increase the library size and create more opportunities for the community.
Yesterday, I met David Johnson on top of the library, just beside the large solar panels fixed to the top of the building. The vacant hospital building below sits on land owned by Washington Regional Medical Center. And the library has put together a package to buy that land to expand a campus that David says is already at or near capacity in almost every way. Events like today's performance by Trout Fishing in America or this summer's forum on the Buffalo River often exceed the seating capacity of the library's largest rooms. David says the expanded library plan includes an auditorium that could seat 750 people.
Just to put that in perspective, we had Dave Barry here just this past spring. I mean, we had over 600 people in a space that certainly is not designed for an author who's going to draw a crowd like that. So we think that a 750-seat sort of civic auditorium that would be open for public use as well, it would accommodate all of our programming needs. But if someone had a particular conference or needed space to bring an entertainer in or somebody, it would be available for them and for the public. The other part of the expansion is we're looking at a total of around 78,000 square feet. We'll be doing things like adding a bunch of additional study rooms, some small rooms where private business, small business can come and do strategic planning and those things. We'll also be looking at increasing the collection size so that, you know, the thing I have to keep in mind and what I challenge everyone to think about is that we're not doing this just for tomorrow. While we do have some short-term gains, we're really thinking about 20 years from now with a community that's projected to grow to 115,000 people. What's a library going to need to be to accommodate their needs? And so we're kind of shooting out there to say 20 years from now, we're going to be at 168,000 square feet.
You have a couple of meetings, I think one Sunday afternoon, one early Monday evening. You're going to have discussions about these plans?
Yeah, Jeff Shear, the architect, will be here as well. We're going to actually unveil some block-type drawings to kind of conceptualize what are we talking about in terms of utilization of the city hospital property space if we get it. We're also really focusing on the programs. What are the things that that the people in the community need now and will need in the future? And we already know in terms of programming space for our book events and for summer reading program, but when we start to really look at the way education is moving and opportunities for creating extensions of the classroom with a smart whiteboard type of study rooms where students can come and share and interact and, you know, actually work on classroom activities and share those with teachers in across town or across the country. It's really going to be a further discussion about what is this community looking for. I know one of the aspect of the conversation will be branch libraries. We've got a lot of feedback with people on the west side of town saying, hey, we'd like to have a branch out here in the Weddington corridor. They've built that into their master plan. We have a lot of people on the north side of town saying, you know, it takes us sometimes 15 or 20 minutes to get to downtown in order to come to an event or whatever. So we're going to open up that dialogue and really talk a lot about where are our branches going to go and what are they going to be? Are they going to be full service libraries? Are they going to be digital branches? Just kind of open up that conversation and see where the community wants to take it.
Is it reasonable to think that there could be branches and the possible expansion here on the main campus?
Yes, that's the one thing I want to make very clear is that when we talk about branches, we're not talking of subtractive from what we want to accomplish here with the Blair Library expansion. So any branch that we build would be in addition to what we want to accomplish here on the downtown footprint.
This, of course, is not happening yet. The offer's been made, but you don't know if you're going to possess this land at all.
Yeah, that's true. Washington Regional was very kind to us in giving us a little bit of time to figure out exactly how much space we needed. Once we determined that, yeah, for us to build the library that this community is going to need, we're going to need some of that land. So we did submit a bid, and we're hoping, keeping our fingers crossed, that between now and whenever they make their decision, that we're in a good position and that they see the value that we're going to return back to the community by being able to utilize that city hospital property.
How much buying the land, building the expansion, what do you think the price tag will be?
You know, that's a good question. It's a fair question. And you know, I think by our best estimates today, this facility costs right around $23, $25 million. We think we can come in underneath that number.
All of it. The land and the building.
Land and the building.
And the infrastructure.
And the infrastructure, yes. So you know, that's our target. That's what we feel like comfortably where we can come in. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is when they built the Blair Library, they had to do a tremendous amount of foundational work, a lot of blasting into hard rock and things, and so that's already there. And they also built this library for expansion. So we are, you know, much of what we're going to do is going to take advantage of infrastructure and design that's already in place.
This is a community center.
Yeah, you know, and if you look across the country, it's not unique to Northwest Arkansas. It's not unique to just this region. It's across the country, you're seeing a movement towards libraries being community centers. Now, a lot of people think that one way to view it is we're spending so much time in our own little personal devices that we have this subconscious desire to be around other folks and to engage other people. But I think as community centers, you know, the library is just further anchoring itself as, a vital institution in a community. And over time, if you look at what libraries have meant, at one time they were just strictly a storehouse of the history. Books didn't really circulate. Then we moved to more of a consumption-oriented model where people could come and check out materials. And now we're even growing and evolving further into that community center and place where people can engage information, not just in materials, but with each other.
David Johnson is the executive director of the Fayetteville Public Library. He talked to me about the library's expansion plans yesterday while we stood on top of the library, a safe distance from the edge. The library will hold sessions seeking opinions on the expansion proposals Sunday afternoon at 3 and again Monday evening at 5:30 at the library.
About 20 dogs, curious about my microphone, tell me how it is inside the kennels of Stanton Animal Hospital on Greenacres Road in Fayetteville. Though they are various sizes and colors, the animals all appear to be past the puppy stage, the prime time when dogs can contract parvo. Recent reports have stated that animal shelters and veterinarians have seen more cases than usual this summer. I contacted my vet, well, my animal's vet, Dr. Douglas Leach with the Stanton Clinic, to find out more about the canine parvovirus.
And that's what canine parvovirus does, is vomiting and diarrhea. And then they lose so much fluids, they become dehydrated, and then they have no appetite, and dehydration is usually what kills those pups.
Puppies that are less than 1 year old are typically the animals affected by it. When puppies are born, Dr. Leach says they have antibodies from their mom. But at 6 weeks old, those maternal antibodies are gone.
That's why you have to start vaccinating at that point. Well, puppies, if they're not vaccinated, they have no protection after they lose those maternal antibodies. Now, adult dogs, if they've been vaccinated, they're not going to get it. So it's unvaccinated puppies that we're going to see the most of it.
A common misconception is that one vaccination protects the pup. Dr. Leach says that when many people get a dog from a breeder or a shelter, that dog has already had one round of vaccinations, but it still needs more.
People misinterpret that as thinking they are finished with their vaccines. They're not. You want to vaccinate puppies starting at 6 weeks and vaccinate every 3 weeks until they get up to 16 weeks of age. So if you vaccinate, we'll see this all the time. A dog's vaccinated at 9 weeks. The people acquired the dog from someone. They said it had its vaccine. They thought it was finished. And here it is at 6 months of age, it's got parvo. Well, if they had just kept vaccinating it every 3 weeks until 16 weeks, it would have been fine. They wouldn't have got it.
Pam Kinslow of Russellville lost two Chihuahua puppies to parvo. The first, Tigger, died at 8 months old. Pam believed that Tigger had had all of the shots he needed.
The lady that we bought him from out of Oklahoma had gotten him for me for Christmas. And she took him to a vet, I believe, in Springdale and had them all with their shots and the parvo. Actually, he had two rounds of something of parvo, and Tigger still got it.
Dr. Leach says that every vaccine a puppy gets will have parvo in it and that it is very effective. Still, as the virus is incredibly contagious, he recommends keeping a new pup at home for a while.
You should not take that puppy out to dog parks or go out to where it's around a lot of other dogs. I'd say probably until it's had at least its third parvo vaccine. Now you can let it in your yard, but just don't let it around where a lot of dogs have been.
And if a dog has had parvo, it's a hardy virus and sticks around a home or a yard for a while.
The virus can live in the soil for greater than 7 months. And if it's frozen, it can live even longer. So the virus is very stable. It lives a long time outside the body. So wherever a dog has that had parvo, had diarrhea or vomit, then that virus is in that substrate, which could be the yard in the soil. Another puppy comes along through there. It's going to acquire it from that.
That's what happened to Pam Kinslow. After Tigger died, she steamed her carpets, cleaned her floors, her walls, even bleached the yard and the sides of her house. And she waited the 7 months her vet told her to wait. In fact, it was almost a year after Tigger died that she got Pee-wee. But after a month or so, Pee-wee, too, got sick.
Pee-wee just started acting kind of sick. Well, see, he wasn't acting that sick or nothing at first, and then he started messing with the frog. And the frog got real mad, and whatever the frog did to him, he started just yapping and shook his head, and then he started to sneeze and sneezed all night long. And then the next morning, he just acted like he didn't want to do anything, was acting sickly-like and stuff, and he had throwed up And I thought, wow, that's weird. So I took him out and was loving on him and trying to feed him and stuff with the little eyedropper thing. And he just didn't want it. So I put him in his little pen until I come back at lunch. And he was still being real sick, and he had pooped on himself. And I thought, oh, no. So I took him to the vet and left him for 2 nights.
There isn't anything that can kill parvo. It is just supportive treatment with IV fluids to keep the pup from getting dehydrated, and antibiotics to keep them from getting a secondary infection. Parvo also reduces the white blood cell count. Treatment is expensive, and that is how most puppies die, because owners can't afford it. If you're willing to try treatment at home, some puppies can survive by giving Pedialyte, but it's tricky to keep it down. Dr. Leach says he hasn't necessarily seen more cases this year over others. Typically, he says they see more animals with it in the summertime because they are out and about more. Plus, there are more flies and insects that can carry the disease. Perhaps that's what happened to Pee-wee when he came into contact with that frog. On average, the Stanton Animal Hospital sees 5 to 7 dogs with parvo each week. Of those, they are able to save about 75%, who go on to be normal dogs.
Yeah, they're going to be pretty thin when they leave the hospital because they haven't eaten in probably 4 or 5 days. But if you look, compare them to a sibling that did not get parvo, at a year of age, it'll have caught up. They will have a normal life afterwards if you can get them through the parvo.
Dogs are the only animals that can get the canine parvovirus, though there is something comparable in cats, feline distemper, but it's rare. Dr. Leach says he hasn't treated a cat for distemper in several years. As for dog lover Pam Kinslow, she says she'd like to get another dog, but she's scared of parvo.
I was hoping to. I had a friend that was going to let me have one, and I never did get back in touch with him because it was a newborn, too, and I was scared it would catch it. They keep getting sick on me. Yeah, I put on Facebook, no more, it hurts.
This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Want to remind you that Friday is Free Cat Friday at the Fayetteville Animal Shelter. All cats, all kittens, free to adopt. Kittens will come spayed or neutered, up to date on shots and microchipped. Applications can be filled out ahead of time to be pre-approved so cats can be taken home on Friday. All cats will be available first come, first serve basis on Friday. Doors open at 10. Numbers will be handed out for those that show up before the doors are open. People could line up beforehand?
I guess
wow.
So. Free cats.
Okay. All adopted cats must leave the shelter in a carrier. The shelter will have cardboard carriers available for $5. For an adoption application or more information, you can go online to accessfayetteville.org.
Yesterday, organizers of the Midtown Music Showcase announced the lineup for the August 17th event to be held at the Evelyn Hills Shopping Center in Fayetteville.
And I have a question about one of these bands because I kind of like their name.
Okay. Dam Arkansan.
Who've been on the on Ozarks before.
Flight Machine.
Okay.
Flip Off Pirates.
They've been on Ozarks.
James Ray Dickard.
Mm-hmm.
And National Park Radio.
Okay, I want to know more about them.
Yeah.
That's my goal for today.
I read that they're local, but...
Yeah, it's very close to, you know...
Yeah.
You could call them... I wonder if fans call them NPR, National Park Radio. I don't know.
Okay. Well, this is the second year for this event, though the name has changed from last year. Last year, it was called the Evelyn Chills Festival. I guess they're trying to do more of a focus on music this year. Mm-hmm. But they will also have food, kid-friendly activities, games, and more. Proceeds will benefit the Fayetteville Public Schools Outback. It's a food pantry and clothing closet for students.
There will be a new literary festival in Fayetteville. It's sponsored by the Fayetteville Public Library in September, called True Lit. It will offer writing workshops, classes on storytelling, several author talks, and more. The event is intended for all ages. You can find out more information just announced yesterday at truelitfest.com.
The University of Arkansas Hog Call, Woo Pig Suey, is a finalist in the Sirius XM College Sports Tradition Tournament this week. The famed signature cheer is competing against the Army-Navy game as the best college football tradition on the Sirius XM College Sports Nation Facebook page. Fans can go to the SiriusXM Facebook page or access the page via ArkansasRazorbacks.com to vote for the hog call until 4:30 p.m. on Friday. Arkansas advanced to the finals after defeating other popular college football traditions in earlier rounds of the online contest, including the famed Hedges at the University of Georgia, the 12th man at Texas A&M University, and Howard's Rock at Clemson University.
And Saturday Dogs and Their People will take to the streets of downtown Siloam Springs. It's the fifth annual Dog Day of Summer Downtown Festival in Twin Springs Park, hosted by Main Street Siloam Springs. It will feature a canine good citizen therapy dog training demonstration, along with dog contests for various categories such as cutest dog and pet and owner look-alike. Registration will begin at 8:30 Saturday morning.
Meredith Martin Motes is a native Arkansan, a passionate reader, and possesses a master's degree in folklore. No surprise that she devours books about Arkansas culture, past and present. She says she can recommend several.
Some of my earliest memories are of my mother reading to me. She greatly valued the written word and all it could offer readers both young and old. I especially remember her taking me to the summer story times at the Arkansas River Valley Library in Dardanelle. The librarians drew us in with their animated stories and hilarious songs, capturing our imagination and sparking our interest in worlds both real and fantastical. With my reading checklist in hand, I would scan the shelves for old favorites and new reads, going home with an armload of books about dogs, horses, and pirate ships. Regardless if you're 8 or 80, summer is the season for story time. The time for making a big reading list and carving out opportunities to explore ideas both new and old. In some ways, radio book reviews can be a bit like the adult version of story time, but I find it rather disappointing that book reviews are almost always about books that have just been published. Some books resonate more deeply over time, and if news programs and journals want to really explore the depth of human history, culture, and daily life, we've got to get away from our focus on the newest thing. After all, isn't that what made story times magical? There was always a focus on exploring the hidden classics, the one that reminded us of the child-sized versions of life lessons, sharing, empathy, justice, and the importance of the little stuff that, in the end, becomes the really big stuff. So with that idea in mind, the series is all about uncovering or rediscovering some readings from the past that can shed light on the complexities of our own state and the lives of the people who create it. This week's book is W.K. McNeil and William M. Clement's book, An Arkansas Folklore Sourcebook. Published in 1992 by the University of Arkansas Press in Fayetteville, this is an excellent resource for anyone interested in learning more about folklore research in the state. Divided into sections such as singing and playing music in Arkansas and customs and beliefs, this book features essays from several Arkansas researchers, including Dr. Cochran of the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies and Mike Luster of the Arkansas Folklife Program discussing folk festivals and celebrations, and former Arkansas Tech University professor Earl F. Scrock on traditional Arkansas foodways. Featuring photos and stories from both Pope and Yale counties, this essay on traditional foods explores the history of food traditions in both the black and white communities, such as sorghum milling and how to make molasses candy, wild greens like poke salad, and the prevalence of wild hogs and the importance of hog killing time, as well as the process of curing both apples and meat. There's also a great deal of information about the ways in which food plays a large role in special events like holidays, weddings, and funerals, helping to bind communities together in times of grief and joy. As Schrock says, quote, "The time-honored custom of providing food for a family on the day of a funeral is still very common throughout the state. If a woman were asked why she's carrying food to a funeral dinner, she'd probably answer, because the family won't feel like cooking. But the real reason is surely that she's providing an outward symbol of the grief that she shares with the family," end quote. Included at the end of the book is an extensive bibliography of books about Arkansas folklore, a discography of audio and music recordings, and a list of films related to Arkansas folklife. No matter how much you've read about the region, this book is sure to introduce you to new ideas and remind you to take a closer look at the everyday goings-on that make up our daily lives. It can be found in regional libraries throughout the state, and it's still available for purchase through the University of Arkansas Press. So what have you been reading this summer? What are some of your favorite books about Arkansas history and culture or related topics? I'd love to hear about them. You can visit me online at boileddownjuice.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
Meredith Martin-Motes is a writer and radio producer. She also is the creative mind behind the blog boileddownjuice.com.
It's Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So yesterday we had history.
Yes. Yes.
Today we have art.
All right.
It's time for the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum's Naturally Diverse Arkansas.
Okay.
Their showcase exhibit, which took a sabbatical 1 year.
I think you're right, yes.
While they were building the new museum.
In the transition.
Moving.
There.
And it will be open through September 1st. There is an $8 charge, $6 for students and senior citizens, but no admission charge in July or August.
Oh. Well,
so how fun is that?
Yeah. So you've got 32 days here.
Exactly.
Okay, you can plan that.
They want people to come and find out what's going on with them. First place, by the way, went to Carol Dickey of Eureka Springs for a watercolor and charcoal work called Tethered. Second place to Dee Dee Hutchison of Fort Smith for an oil on canvas mount magazine. And third place to Eureka Springs artist Ron Lutz's pinhole photograph Bluffs.
Okay.
We also have Art on the Creeks. That would be tomorrow from 1 to 8 at Village on the Creeks in Rogers. It benefits the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas. And Friday at Crystal Bridges, a program called Intersection. Afrique Aya explores the sound suit.
All right.
How fun does that sound?
It sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
7:30 on Friday, and I believe it's free.
Yeah, I believe it is.
Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This Week in This American Life.
You're not going to go drink that soda in there, are you?
Yes, I am.
No.
What
the soda
you know?
Is ancient. And the fridge is filled with roaches.
The fridge is not filled with roaches.
Why don't you take a look and see what's in here?
In his mid-30s, Josh moved back home to take care of his alcoholic mom.
Dead roaches everywhere.
Well, they're dead. They can't hurt me anymore.
This Week on This American Life.
This American Life, Saturday morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
The 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series concludes with a performance from the Amina Figueroa Quintet at Walton Arts Center Star Theater Friday, August 16th. This composer, arranger, orchestra leader, and her ensemble offer a distinctive voice while performing an all-original repertoire. Tickets and more information available online at KUAF.com. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, South Lead Hill.
South Lead Hill.
Yes.
As opposed to Lead Hill.
Yes.
Okay.
And South Lead Hill is south of Lead Hill.
I wonder how big it is.
It's not that big. It's in Boone County. Someday, when you have absolutely nothing else to do, I'll tell you why there's a South Lead Hill and a Lead Hill. It involves the theft of a post office.
Okay. Right. Well, and if you were South Lead Hill,
yes.
Who would your mascot
be?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. And that continues our contest, which we're continuing for another 24 hours, to win 4 tickets to a Northwest Arkansas Naturals game, 4 movie passes to a Malco movie, any area Malco movie theater. And we launched this yesterday. Take a town of 3,000 or fewer people in Arkansas and give them a clever mascot. We've had about 50 entries so far. I'm enjoying reading them so much that I'm going to go another day.
Yeah, and you can submit your entry at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
One of the best ones I've gotten so far can't win because it's Molly Ron, who works here.
Right.
Her grandmother was born in the town of Noble, and she suggested the Noble Prizes.
Well, and my grandmother was born in Meg, Arkansas, and I said, well, what about the Meg Ryans?
So you get the idea of what we're looking for.
Yeah.
We've had some pretty good ones. But you can still go and give us your idea at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. Thanks so much for participating.
And Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. We're back tomorrow for another brand new edition.
Thanks for listening.